Good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you 24/7 wherever you are by checking it out in your favorite podcast app. Just search for the Nick Craig Show, whether that's Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, just search for the Nick Craig Show. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. We have got a jam-packed show for you this morning. A lot of movement happening across the state of North Carolina this morning, and we'll be diving into some details on the RAINS Act, a very interesting piece of legislation that is being brought forth in the North Carolina General Assembly. It deals with agencies within the government that have incredible amounts of power, make regulation. We'll be joined by Tyler Voigt from Americans for Prosperity here in North Carolina, coming up here just a little bit later on in the program, diving into those details. However, we do start off with some breaking news out of Raleigh this morning, as Governor Josh Stein has signed his first bill into law, as he is the governor here in North Carolina, and that is Hurricane Helene relief for Western North Carolina. More than $500 million in new relief aid is heading to the western half of this state, a cash injection intended to boost rebuilding efforts in the region after, of course, the devastation that we all saw play out in September. Stein signed this into law last night around 7 o'clock. It did pass the Senate yesterday during the day, and Governor Josh Stein said, quote, "Urgency is driving us so much that when these guys passed the bill this afternoon, I asked them, could they come over tonight? I didn't want to wait until tomorrow to sign this bill because it's that important." So this $524 million that was moved through the House, moved through the Senate, and signed by Governor Josh Stein last night is aimed to kickstart rebuilding efforts, specifically looking at homes, farms, and private roads in the western half of the state. It also has money for a tourism campaign, which, as you're well aware, is one of the main drivers of the western North Carolina economy, as well as funds to help local governments rebuild their downtown business districts. Stein, at the signing ceremony last night, had some additional comments about it. This is what the governor had to say.
Beneficiaries from their good work. There are members of the Western delegation here. There are members of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Relief for Western North Carolina. You'll see a number of law enforcement representatives here as well. These are folks that the folks up out west didn't have time to come down the mountain, but these are law enforcement leaders in the Piedmont and in the east who, after the storm, sent their folks out west to help their neighbors. And so let's thank these leaders in law enforcement. We also have Farm Bureau President Sean Harding. As you all know, many farms in Western North Carolina really took it on the chin, losing their crops, having their soil washed down the river. The recovery is going to be long and hard. We have representation from our state agricultural department. Commissioner couldn't be here, but he's got a big chunk of this pie, and we got to work hard to make sure that those funds help our agricultural folks, our farmers out west. There are members from the Grow North Carolina team, Grow NC. That's the governor's recovery office for Western North Carolina, including the head, Matt Calabria. Where's Matt? Right there, good. I told Matt, I was like, all right, get to work. These guys, they filled the coffers, or at least started filling the coffers, and now we got to get to work. My team will tell you there are four values that drive the work we do in Western North Carolina recovery. It's urgency, focus, transparency, and accountability. And urgency is the most important. We've got to do everything we can to get these monies in Western North Carolina where they can make a difference in people's lives. And as Representative Green said, we have to spend this money as effectively as we possibly can. We want every dollar to have a maximum impact on people's lives out west.
I'm going to pause the governor right there, and I've got to give him credit here. I mean, you look at the failures of the past administration. You look at the failures of NCOR that was the darling, the baby of Governor Roy Cooper. NCOR was supposed to deal with hurricane relief and recovery from hurricanes Matthew and Florence. Those affected the states in 2016 and 2018. And to this day, you've heard me say it a whole bunch of times, to this day, there are still more than 1,000 families that are not back in their homes from those storms. 2016 and 2018. Now, of course, the blame was, COVID slowed everything down and there was an administration change between Trump and Biden. Just a bunch of weak, useless excuses from the previous administration. Roy Cooper buried his head in the sand on Eastern North Carolina recovery. Josh Stein obviously saw the impact, saw the situation unfolding in the eastern half of the state, and it appears that he is not going to allow history to repeat itself. And that's phenomenal, because when we talk about the failures of government, especially in regards to hurricane relief, right? We talk about the failures of government with hurricane relief. We're not just talking about government. We're talking about everyday individuals getting hurt because of the useless, ineffective nature of their state government. Right? We're talking about real impacts on people's lives that have been living in temporary housing for 8+ years under the previous governor's failed North Carolina Office of Recovery and Resiliency. And it appears obvious to me that Josh Stein realizes this, and he is not going to allow this to happen with the western half of the state. And not to minimize Matthew, not to minimize Florence, like many of you, I was in Wilmington for Florence, stayed here. It was a massive storm. But when you look at the devastation and destruction in the western half of the state, I mean, it almost doesn't compare to what those two storms had. Hurricane Helene is the deadliest storm that this state has ever seen. It did an estimated, what, $60 billion in damage? $60 billion. That's more than double what the state budget is every year. Killed over 100 people. And so if the state managed to botch the eastern recovery so bad, it's obvious and it's imperative that Governor Josh Stein, that the North Carolina legislature and his GRO-NC office, the governor's recovery office for Western North Carolina, does not repeat the same situation. Because if so, Western North Carolina will cease to exist. Plain and simple. There will be no such thing as Western North Carolina if this recovery goes and follows the same path, follows the same playbook, follows the same examples that we saw out of NCOR. There's no shot in hell that they ever recover. Right? They don't have the luxury that the eastern half of the state had in terms of the geography and the population boom. It's just not going to happen out west. It's obvious that Governor Stein and his team know that, and to their credit, they are getting ahead of this issue and being laser focused on it. He talks about his four priorities. He says urgency is one of the big ones. I agree with that. And he talks about accountability and transparency. Now, it's easy to say that. It's hard to put it into practice, and I look forward to seeing the transparency. Look forward to seeing the accountability from this recovery out west. More from the governor last night.
Urgency is driving us so much that when these guys passed this bill this afternoon, I asked them, could they come over tonight? I didn't want to wait till tomorrow to sign this bill because it's that important. First day, the first series of executive orders I signed dealt with Hurricane Helene. First trip was, as Senator Mayfield said, out to Asheville. The first order of business that begins every daily meeting and every cabinet meeting I have is on the agenda, what is the status of Hurricane Helene relief? So I am incredibly proud that the first bill I will sign as governor is this Hurricane Helene relief package. This bill shows that when we work together, we can get really good things done for the people of this state. It represents a promising start on getting aid out west. The money is going to help towns rebuild infrastructure necessary for business. It will help fund home reconstruction. It will help repair private roads and bridges. It will support our farmers, as I said, rehabilitate their soil and get compensation for the lost crops. And I am also grateful, as the speaker noted, that the bill will include funds over $200 million to help us help the folks in eastern North Carolina still without permanent housing after Hurricanes Florence and Matthew. It will help us to finish the job. I am looking forward to completing that critical mission. As the speaker said, this is the first instance, this is what the bill number is, Hurricane Relief Number One, I think, is what the bill actually is titled. And we are also going to get right back to work. I'm going to get with my cabinet, I'm going to get with the budget team, and we're going to come up with another proposal to share with the legislature as they wrestle with what we need to do next to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help people in Western North Carolina get back up on their feet. We still have work to do. There are small businesses out west that are truly struggling, struggling to keep their doors open, struggling to keep their employees hired. We need to make sure that they keep people on the job and they keep generating revenue to support local governments and local communities. We still need to invest in affordable housing because too many renters have lost their home. Home reconstruction helps you if you own your home, but not everybody owns their own home. A lot of folks are renters, and they need a place to live as well. We have to reduce the risk of wildfires, particularly as the summer starts to come. We need to invest in resiliency, whether that's how to deal with flooding or downed power lines or any other way to make sure that if the next storm comes, we are better prepared to handle it. So we will be sending a second Helene recovery package to the legislature in the coming weeks. We also collectively have to do our work with the federal government. The scale of this storm is beyond our understanding, $60 billion. It is by far the largest storm this state has ever had to face. And there's not $60 billion in the state coffers to pay for this. We'll never be made whole, but the only entity that can truly help us make a meaningful impact on recovery is our federal government. We need more funding from Washington, and I will make that case, as I have been making that case, that we need more appropriations. We also need for FEMA to agree with a 100% cost recovery for debris removal for another 6 months. It expires in 8 days, the 100% match. We need to make sure that that is extended because there is so much more debris left to be collected. I want to thank the legislators who worked so hard to get this into law. But fundamentally, I want to thank the people of Western North Carolina for their strength, their generosity, their resilience. You all have time and again shown what it means to be North Carolina strong, and it is for you and because of you that I'm honored to sign this bill into law.
So then the governor then, of course, goes over and signs the legislation. And I'll tell you this, it's still early, and I've mentioned this over the last couple of weeks. It's still early in this new administration. Stein has only been on the job since the beginning of January, right? He's going through his third month of being governor right now. But this communication and this collaboration with the General Assembly on Hurricane Helene, which fortunately is a bipartisan issue. Fortunately, there's not huge political divides being drawn on hurricane relief. Right? So much of what we talk about is so politically polarizing for one side or the other. And fortunately, this is not one of those issues. And so it's great to see this working relationship between the governor and the General Assembly. This is something that is, I'll say, relatively new in North Carolina. In the final couple years of the Cooper administration, there was essentially no working relationship between the General Assembly and the governor. They were so diametrically opposed on almost every single issue. I mean, Roy Cooper vetoed like 40 bills in the last couple of years, over all of them overridden by the General Assembly. I mean, there was just no coming together on anything. And that's bad, irregardless of the party. That's a bad situation where you've got a legislature and a governor that cannot work together on almost anything. The honeymoon period is still on. There's no question. There's no doubt about that. This relationship is still relatively new. The budget discussion that I'll have coming up here in just a few minutes, that is likely to probably cause some fights between the governor, between the General Assembly. This is a really, really good change. And I think the end result is a better form of state government. Right, when you have the governor working with the GA, when you have the GA working with the governor on things that they can come together on, that's good for North Carolina. That's good for our residents. Now, things are going to get heated. We know Governor Josh Stein is a progressive in his ideology. We know that he is a progressive in the things that he stands for the policies that he wants to bring forward. And that's obvious in his budget proposal that he also brought forth yesterday. But when you can erase that, at least temporarily, for something like hurricane relief, which impacts every individual in the state, regardless of whether they're a Democrat, a Republican, a liberal, a conservative, a progressive, a libertarian, it doesn't matter where you fall on the political spectrum. This affects everybody equally out in the western half of the state. When you can erase that, when there can be a joint bill signing like you saw last night with Speaker Destin Hall, Phil Berger, I don't think was there. It was obviously relatively last minute. But when you've got the Speaker of the House there, when you've got the governor there, when you've got leaders within the administration there, that is a good thing for North Carolina. So I've got to give the governor credit. I've got to give the General Assembly credit. This is a very tough issue for them to deal with. You are talking about a $60 billion storm that is going to tie up billions of dollars that North Carolina was not planning to spend. Now, fortunately, over the last decade or so, Republicans in the General Assembly have done a phenomenal job cleaning up the state's finances. They have done a remarkable job balancing the budget, cutting taxes, and increasing spending. They've been able to do all of those things in unison. I'll remind you, 2007, 8, and 9, under a 100 plus years of Democrat control in the GA, under Democrat Governor Bev Perdue, the state was buried in debt. The state was furloughing teachers, furloughing individuals, state law enforcement officers, members of SHP, because they didn't have any money. The state owed the federal government hundreds of millions of dollars. The financial status of this state was abysmal. Taxes were sky high. There was an unfriendly business climate. North Carolina 10, 12, 15 years ago was a very different state. The political makeup was incredibly different. The financial standing was completely different. It was a rough time in North Carolina. That was after 100 plus years of Democrat control in the legislature, almost exclusively. Fortunately, the GA has spun that around, and it's put North Carolina in a position where we can handle something like Helene. As the governor noted, we're never going to be whole on this. There's no argument about that. The state was not anticipating allocating at this point. The state has allocated over $1.5 billion for hurricane relief. $1 billion last year before the end of 2024, two different relief packages there, and then another $524 million over the last couple of days in the GA. $1.5 billion. That would have not been possible 12 or 15 years ago. That would not have been possible because the state didn't have the money. There was nothing in reserves. There was no rainy day fund. There was no extra money. To allocate that money, the state would have had to make major cuts and likely would have had to lay off employees or furlough employees to set aside that money to make that money available. That's not the case anymore, and there's one reason for it. Fiscal conservative policies out of our General Assembly. So while the governor should take credit, as he should, for the success in this legislation, we've got to look back as to why this is possible. And it's because of strong fiscal policy. Good governance coming out of the General Assembly. Do not let that be lost on you as this continues to take place. Many other states would not be in the same position that North Carolina is right now. They would have no ability to fund this stuff internally. They would be begging and pleading and waiting on the federal government to send that money. And will the federal government kick in? Absolutely. Will the federal government allocate likely tens of billions of dollars to the storm? Yes, that's the plan. That's what's being discussed right now. But as we know, unfortunately, the slow wheels of the federal government, things take forever. They take forever. And when they are available, they come with red tape. They come with all of these strings attached. They come with incredible amounts of bureaucracy. That's an issue because, as the governor noted, urgency is the key. This storm happened in September of last year. Seems like it was forever ago, but it was somewhat recently. And that devastation, the 74 plus thousand homes that were damaged or destroyed, Those homes need to be rebuilt. The towns like Chimney Rock that are completely wiped off the map, those towns need to be rebuilt. All of the small businesses that thrive off of tourism, it's not all that different, folks, from what we see here on the Eastern Coast. It's not all that different than the boom in population that Wilmington and Brunswick and Pender County see and will begin to see starting here in the next month or two and going through the rest of the summer. So many of our local and small businesses thrive because of the influx of cash that they get during the tourism season. And it's no different out in Western North Carolina, except it's a different time of the year. It's the fall, winter, and spring months where Western North Carolina shines, where so many individuals travel to the western half of the state to enjoy the sights, enjoy the views, enjoy all that Western North Carolina has. Now, I was fortunate to make a trip out there like 3 weeks before Helene. I was over in Burnsville on a camping trip, and what a remarkable area. Went to the top of Mount Mitchell. I mean, what a cool place to visit. What a cool place to be. It's not going to be rebuilt automatically. The money has got to be there. The effort has got to be there from state government. And big time, the accountability and the transparency has to be there. We cannot repeat our mistakes of the past when it comes to hurricane recovery. The state literally cannot afford it. Western North Carolina will cease to exist if we don't handle this correctly. The steps are being taken. Good bipartisan leadership is happening between the GA and the governor's office, between GRO-NC and the legislature. Things are going to get contested. Things are going to get heated. No argument about it. Things appear, and appearance is an important part of it, but rubber meets the road. It's a different story. It appears that things are heading in the right direction right now. This is very good news for our state, and hopefully lessons were learned from the past. Hopefully the past failures of this state have been corrected and moved forward. That is great news. So we'll continue to keep an eye on this just to kind of keep you up to date where things are likely to head. The next influx of cash, the next hurricane relief bill, if you want to call it that, is likely to come through the state budget. That is where this is likely to take place. Now, there was a quote from Senate Leader Phil Berger, who said that if the state budget is delayed, it's supposed to be passed, done, and in effect July 1st. Over the last couple of years, there's been some major disagreements between the House, between the Senate on this, and it has delayed that process well past July, and even some cases into the winter. Senate Leader Phil Berger has said that if the 2025 budget debate runs into problems, that they would likely pass a Helene aid package separately. Hopefully that doesn't take place. Hopefully Phil Berger and Destin Hall can get together, bring those two chambers together, and get a budget in place by July 1, maybe even earlier than that. Get that done, get that squared away. That would be your next influx of cash. If that doesn't seem like that's possible, if that doesn't seem like that's going to happen, then there'll likely be a separate bill. So at least for the time being, $1.5 billion, more than $1.5 billion doled out by the General Assembly. Federal money should hopefully begin flowing over the next couple of months. You heard there some comments from Stein over the next 7 days. The 100% reimbursement from the federal government is set to run out. I'm not sure that's going to be extended. The federal government has got major financial issues that they're dealing with right now, and I don't know if they can justify that kind of cash. I don't know if they can justify another 6 months of 100% reimbursement on cleanup. I don't know if that's feasible. So there's still going to be a lot going on, but at least from the state allocation standpoint, we appear to be done at least for right now. Things will probably start kicking back up over the next couple of months. But right now, the money is set out, and that's when the accountability and the transparency pieces come into play. All right, it's one thing to allocate the funds. It's one thing to set the money aside for it to be spent. It's another thing for it to be used and spent effectively. And that's what I'll be keeping a very close eye on right here. We'll continue to bring you the news and analysis of that right here on The Nick Craig Show. Turning to some other statewide news this morning, a sheriff across North Carolina is in violation of North Carolina law. A press release from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, reads as follows. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, along with law enforcement partners from the FBI, U.S. Marshal Service, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, apprehended 24 illegal aliens in Charlotte during an enhanced target enforcement operation that ran March the 1st through the 8th. Charges for those arrested include 13 aggravated felonies or other violent offenses, 3 illegal firearms or weapon offenses, 2 MS-13 gang member affiliation cases, 1 assault on a federal officer, 5 property crimes, and 11 DWI charges. Now, that's great news. These individuals were apprehended. These individuals were charged. Here's where things get tricky. This is reading directly from the ICE press release. Of these criminal aliens, 6 had active immigration detainers with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Sheriff's Office that had not been honored. There are 18 additional targeted aliens still at large who also had detainers that were not honored. ICE has been unable to locate these individuals, and they remain at large and pose a potential danger to the community. These aliens could have been safely and effectively transferred into ICE custody if the detainers had not been honored. This brings forth the Mecklenburg County Sheriff, Gary McFadden, one of just a handful of sheriffs in North Carolina that was not complying with state law in regards to them working with the federal government, specifically working with ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to honor those detainers. The North Carolina General Assembly passed legislation to mandate that all 100 county sheriffs across our state work with ICE. There is a law on the books dealing with this issue. And for whatever reason, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff is not honoring those requests. He is in violation of state law this morning. ICE calls it right out in their press release that, again, these aliens could have been safely and efficiently transferred into ICE custody if the detainers had been honored. Not only should the detainers have been honored, but they are legally required to be honored under the state government. House Bill 10 does exactly that. Now, I don't know what's going to happen as a result of this. The law is on the book. I don't know what the ramifications are, what the consequences, what the penalties are. I'll just tell you flat out what I think about it. I think the Attorney General, who of course is a Democrat, so this is never going to happen, but I think the Attorney General needs to march his happy ass down to Charlotte and arrest the sheriff. I think the sheriff, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff, and Gary McFadden needs to be charged and arrested. He is absolutely publicly in opposition and working against state law. And there's no place for that. The General Assembly very clearly passed legislation to compel sheriffs to work with ICE on federal detainers. There was no ifs, there was no ands, there was no buts. It was explicitly clear as to what needed to be done. Yet progressive sheriffs like the which Gary McFadden is in Mecklenburg County, the city of Charlotte, the radical that he is, has continually decided that he does not care what the state law is. He has proven time and time again, whether it was pistol purchase permits, whether it was dealing with ICE, that he doesn't give a damn as to what the state law is. And he is going to do whatever he wants. State law be damned. The General Assembly be damned. The safety and citizens of residents in and around the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area be damned. He doesn't care. That's a major, major problem. Now, this press release came out on the 18th. I believe it was posted on the night of the 18th. Didn't see anything about it yesterday. Likely to make some more news today. Shout out to AP Dillon over at the North State Journal for posting this on X. That's where I saw it last night. She brought this to light. Now, so the question is now what happens? when you have a sheriff that is actively working against state law, that is actively breaking state law, that compels him to honor ICE detainer requests, what do you do? What's the process here? How is accountability laid upon the Mecklenburg County Sheriff? I think it needs to be thrown in jail. I think an example needs to be set. If you are a sheriff, an elected position, right? Not, we're not talking about a police chief that is appointed by a city council or a town council. We're talking about a duly elected sheriff who individuals in Mecklenburg County, for whatever freaking reason, continue to elect Gary McFadden for. But a duly elected sheriff that is actively working against state law. And the result of that is people in Charlotte, people in Mecklenburg County are less safe because of his actions. The fact that the General Assembly, let me step back for a second. The fact that the General Assembly had to pass a law to compel sheriffs to work with ICE is insane. Now, Gary McFadden claimed, well, there's no state law. And, you know, the reason I'm not doing this is there could be some constitutional questions over whether I have the authority to hold these people. He tried concocting some weird reason as to why he didn't feel it was appropriate for him to honor those ICE detainers. So the General Assembly said, okay, Sheriff McFadden, touche. So they changed the law, compelling these sheriffs to do so. And lo and behold, like a typical liberal radical Democrat, that wasn't the actual issue, right? Moving the goalpost, changing the rules of the game. Now the law's in place. Now the law's in effect, and he's still not complying with it. So it was never about that the law wasn't clear. He claimed that he could open the sheriff's office to litigation because he was holding people improperly. It was never about that. It was a good excuse. The General Assembly called this bluff, and in a typical radical progressive manner and form, he is continuing to defy state law. This is likely to be a major issue that you're going to see blow up. I'll keep an eye on it, and we'll see what happens. Does the Democrat Attorney General and Jeff Jackson do anything about it? I can promise you if Dan Bishop was in the AG's office, he'd probably be down in Mecklenburg County this morning. But will radical progressive Jeff Jackson do anything? My guess, probably not. And so then it's going to cause the General Assembly, I guess, to have to rewrite legislation once again and put in, if you don't comply with this, you're going to be thrown in jail. I don't know what they have to do. The law is as clear as could possibly be. You have to honor federal detainer requests from ICE. There's no ambiguity in the legislation. Yet the Mecklenburg County Sheriff is doing whatever he wants. This is a major problem that is making our streets less safe, and it's a major problem that has people questioning the safety and security of the communities in which they live, where I will note they deserve to be safe from individuals who are illegally in these countries. 13 aggravated felonies, 3 illegal firearms or weapon charges, 2 MS-13 gang members, 1 assault on a federal officer, 5 property crimes, and 11 DWI charges. All of that against 24 individuals. These are not individuals that you want in your community. These are not individuals that you want in your neighborhood. These are dangerous, violent gang members. And the Mecklenburg County Sheriff says, who cares? Let him back out on the street. That's exactly what happens. When the sheriff ignores the ICE detainer request, these individuals are released. They are currently roaming around. If they're smart, they've left. But they're currently roaming around the Charlotte metro area as we speak this morning. What a slap in the face to the law-abiding citizens of Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte. Shame on Gary McFadden. What an awful representation of North Carolina. Awful representation of our state to ICE. We'll keep an eye on it right here on the Nick Craig Show. If you are interested in getting exclusive access to the program, including daily show notes and our monthly Zoom call that we do with our supporters coming up next week, I encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig. You can support the show financially, $5, $10 a month. You can set a custom amount as well. You'll get access to those daily show notes, the monthly hangout, and more all over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Greatly appreciate everybody's support of the Nick Craig Show as we embark on our second month here in this new form of media. We've got a lot more news to get into, including Governor Josh Stein's budget proposal. Trump signed to set an executive order in regards to the Department of Education. That is slated to come up later this afternoon. And then we'll dive into a very interesting piece of legislation known as the RAINS Act with Tyler Voigt from Americans for Prosperity across North Carolina. All that coming up and more as the Nick Craig Show continues, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and available 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. A jam-packed Thursday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Welcome back. Streaming live on YouTube, Rumble, and X 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. We turn our attention this morning back to state government. A big announcement yesterday as a Democrat Governor Josh Stein has announced his budget recommendation. I'll make sure that you note a budget recommendation coming from the governor. The governor is not part of the budget process in North Carolina, at least the crafting of that budget. He makes his recommendations to the General Assembly. This is pretty standard across the state. He makes his recommendations and the Republican, the Republican-led General Assembly, well, they decide if they want to use anything from the governor's budget or not. And there's a lot of stuff in here that is rather interesting, a major increase. According to fiscal policy analyst over at the John Locke Foundation, Joseph Harris, he says, Governor Josh Stein's budget proposal recommends spending $33.6 billion in the fiscal year 25-26, or an increase of 6.3% from last year's total, which was $31.6 billion. Harris notes within the $2 billion increase, $700 million would go to expanding Medicaid across the state. Another $700 million would fund increases for state employees and retiree pays, as well as $153 million allocated to the state health plan. Now, there's a couple of main pieces that I actually wrote this article over at CarolinaJournal.com that I pulled out as the governor's priority. The first is education. Stein, following up on some comments from his State of the State address last week, is aiming to make North Carolina's starting teacher pay the highest across the Southeast. With an average salary of $53,000 a year for starting teachers by fiscal year 26-27. The governor's plan also includes a 10.6% average pay raise for teachers, as well as reinstating master degree teacher pay statewide. His proposal also includes expanding free school breakfast for every student across the state, adding more mental health professionals in school. And this is a really interesting one. He's proposing a $4 billion bond to address school infrastructure needs. This has been interesting to watch, right? There's capital expenses and expenditures within the school districts are high. And they're very, very expensive, as many of these schools at this point are 50, 60 years old, right? These schools are in constant need of repair, and it's very expensive. Very, very expensive. And most of the time, those capital expenses are coming from local governments. But your local county commissioners are the ones that have to go forth and cover the expenses on that. Now, here's the governor last week when he brought this up during his State of the State address. This is how he laid out this $4 billion bond, which would be on a ballot if it goes forward for North Carolina. Take a listen to the governor.
Our students also need safe and well-built schools. Unfortunately, too many of our schools are overcrowded or use trailers or have old leaking roofs and broken heating and air conditioning. It is 2025. We should not have to send kids home from school because the heat doesn't work. We need safer, healthier, and more modern schools. So tonight, I'm proposing a $4 billion public school bond. And if you're not sure about it, let's let the voters decide.
Now, as I mentioned there, this is a proposed recommendation from the governor. It does not compel the General Assembly to do anything with it. And it's an interesting discussion. I'm not sure that the GA is going to move forward with a $4 billion bond to address this stuff. I'm not sure they're going to, but it's something that the governor seems pretty happy about. Now the battle is on over the Opportunity Scholarship Program. You're well aware of that. It's been a major increase in the state over the last couple of years, giving families, regardless of their income level, the option to send their children to a different school that fits their needs if they don't have the financial means to do so. In the governor's plan, funding for the Opportunity Scholarship Program would be placed under a moratorium that offers no new awards and gradually decreases future funding for the program. That, of course, puts Stein at odds with state law and with Republican lawmakers who have expressed interest in fully funding the program going forward. Now, last year, more than 55,000 families sat on the wait list for OPS, the Opportunity Scholarship Program, until lawmakers voted and successfully allocated more funds to it. Joseph Harris from the John Locke Foundation said, quote, Stein's budget aims to increase pay for teachers and funding for public education at the expense of reducing funding for opportunity scholarships. That is going to be an issue. I was just talking earlier about the current relationship, which seems pretty good, between the governor, between the legislature. If there is an issue that breaks them apart, it undoubtedly will be the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Republicans are laser focused on school choice, as they should be. Right? There's this weird concept from the left that the only way your child can get an education is by sending them to a public school. And if the public school doesn't work for you, well, then you're SOL. You shouldn't have an option. We don't want you to have the ability to send your kids to a private school. We don't want the ability for you to homeschool your children, irregardless of this education they're actually getting. The progressive left wants to control education, and there's a pretty good reason why. The public education system is the best tool that they have for indoctrination. The public school system is the best avenue they have to take young individuals and feed their minds with wacky, radical, out-of-control leftist ideology. They have done a masterful job, that them being the Democrats, they have done a masterful job using the public education system to push forward their agenda, to push forward their radical, crazy liberal ideas. They started at a very young age in the public school system, and they've done a masterful job at it. The Opportunity Scholarship Program is an area in which, well, they don't have that same ability, right? Because when you send your kids to a private school, well, they're no longer going to jump into the crazy partisan nonsense, or most of them don't, that you see that unfortunately play out in the public school system. Stein, just like his predecessor Cooper, very much against the OPS program. The Republican General Assembly seems hell-bent that they're going to keep it going forward. That's probably going to be a major issue. Turning to workforce development, the governor advocated for expanding access to free community college in high-demand fields, also proposing a $20 million investment in apprenticeships and work-based learning programs. So that's what he wants to do on workforce development. In terms of childcare and early education, his plan allocates over $630 million reoccurring per year to increase childcare subsidies, as well as expanding NC Pre-K by adding 1,000 seats and establishing a summer learning program to help pre-K graduates transition into kindergarten. Turning to public safety, Stein stressed the importance of law enforcement in this proposal. He said, quote, investing in public safety requires investing in the professionals who protect us. Law enforcement officers put themselves in harm's way to keep our communities safe, but widespread vacancies in law enforcement make it harder for them to do their job. His plan increases law enforcement salaries with hiring bonuses to attract new officers, invests in the fentanyl crisis response by adding new drug agents and financial investigators, provides body cameras for all field-based state-level law enforcement officers, as well as funding 330 new school resource officers. Here are some other budget items that were included in the governor's proposal, some pretty big ones here. $530 million annually in tax relief, including refundable tax credits, one for working families, the other for child independent care, and the third an additional child tax credit. The second bullet point is a big one, freezing corporate and personal income tax rates. There is currently law on the books in the current budget proposals and the current budget, both the personal and corporate income tax rates are proposed to continue to decrease. The corporate tax rate is set to completely evaporate over the next couple of years, personal income tax rate continuing to drop. Governor Stein's proposal says stop all those decreases. Keep the tax rates where they are right now. And it makes sense. He's asking to spend an extra $3 billion, a 6.3% increase in his budget. He's going to have to pay for it. And the way you do that, well, you stop lowering people's taxes. So that's a major issue that he is also, once again, going to likely break with the General Assembly on. He wants to expand Medicaid growth, invest $500 million for disaster relief, increase unemployment benefits, raising the maximum weekly payment to $470, as well as deal with some housing issues, $15 million annually for affordable housing loans, and $35 million via housing finance agency programs. So that's the governor's proposal. It is a lengthy one. I went through it yesterday. It is a whopping 261 pages, as I had the coverage over at CarolinaJournal.com yesterday. It is nothing more than a proposal. As I mentioned, the General Assembly is not compelled to do anything that the governor recommends. Will they take some pieces out of it? Probably. You can have parallel thoughts, and I'm sure the GA is in favor of some of the same things that the governor is. So you'll likely see some of the governor's recommendations make their way into a potential final budget that is brought forth by the General Assembly. But I would suspect, and I think I can say with pretty good confidence this morning, that a vast majority of the governor's recommendations will not end up in final budget talks. A vast majority of what the governor wants is likely not to move forward, at least in what the Republicans propose. And that will, of course, bring the major battle coming up in the summer of this year. The General Assembly is going to work together. I pray that the House and the Senate can get together on a budget. And then it's going to beg the question, what does Governor Stein do? Does he veto the budget and then let it go back for a veto override? Who knows? It's going to be very interesting to follow, and it's really where you will see if there's going to be major breaks between the governor and the General Assembly. The budget is a great opportunity for that to take place. Now, as I noted, the Republicans are not compelled to do anything, but they should look at it, and if there's some good ideas in there, they should take it. But some of these radical things that are in there, like stopping the Opportunity Scholarship Program, like pausing tax rate decreases for North Carolinians, that stuff's not going to pass. Now, the governor's got to do his bidding. He's got to do his part. He's got to, you know, do what his party wants him to do and follow through on his ideology and the things that he stands for, the things that he ran on in his campaign. He's got to do that. And so this is nothing new, but it was a very interesting proposal. You can read the story this morning over at CarolinaJournal.com. And if you're so inclined, you can scroll through the 260-plus page budget recommendation from Governor Josh Stein yesterday. It'll be interesting to see. I have not seen any reaction from Republican lawmakers. Maybe we'll see that in the coming days and weeks. If so, and if it's interesting or something worth talking about, we'll bring it to you right here. There's been some major legislation moving forward in North Carolina. It's known as the RAINS Act, and Tyler Voigt from Americans for Prosperity joins us to discuss those details this morning. We are tracking some new legislation out of the General Assembly this morning as it deals with rules and regulations coming out of the executive branch of state government. To get some additional details on that, it's my pleasure to welcome Tyler Voigt from Americans for Prosperity across North Carolina to our airwaves this morning on the Nick Craig Show. Tyler, thanks for the time. Walk us through the RAINS Act. That was a big press conference earlier this week. Why is it relevant to regular everyday citizens across North Carolina?
Yeah, Nick, thanks for having me. So basically, it's no surprise to anybody. It was a large talking point through the election last year. There is an entrenched bureaucracy in the United States of the federal government and the state government. The North Carolina is no exception to that. And this bureaucracy is creating rules that impact North Carolinians every single day, whether that means new regulations on things. And each one of those rules, when it's created by this bureaucracy, by this rulemaking body, has a price tag. Now, most North Carolinians, they never see that. They never hear about it, but they do pay for it in lots of different ways and lots of different, in just a plethora of different rules. I think there's about 111,000 rules on the books right now that are impacting folks. So you guys are paying for it. North Carolinians are paying for it. And it's kind of AFP's view and a lot of members of the General Assembly's view that when these rules hit a certain financial impact, which is set at $1 million a year, that should really not be taking place with unelected bureaucrats who oftentimes their bosses aren't even elected. They're making these laws that are impacting North Carolinians financially every single day. That should not be rested with them. That should be rested with people who are accountable to the voters. And that is our General Assembly, our State House, and our State Senate. So we've had champions who have been really excited about this legislation. And Alan Chesser's kind of taken it by storm in the House. And that's what we saw on Tuesday was his press conference talking about the introduction of this bill and how this is going to be a priority for us to get passed in this session.
Now, of course, as we look at North Carolina politics, the dynamics are a little bit different now. It's still a Democrat governor. However, a brand new governor in Josh Stein. Republicans do hold majorities in the House and the Senate. Tyler, is this a bipartisan situation? Is this something that just is pretty much only being run by Republicans? Where's this breaking amongst party lines?
Yeah, so it's a strange bill because we are in a very polarizing time. And it's North Carolina is no exception to that. However, we've ran some polling this year. We were in the field last week that showed that this is an 80-20 issue among voters. 75% of Democrats support this issue. It is an issue that is overwhelmingly supported by the public. We've seen multiple states across the country, including South Carolina, where it's got just large Democrat support in their state houses. We're very much hoping that we see the same in North Carolina as this kind of goes through the progression. Right now, we have a lot of co-sponsors on it. We'd love to see some Democrats come out, speak in favor of this. I mean, they understand the need of accountability, too. They understand it as well as both sides, Republicans and Democrats. They want to see if these rules are impacting North Carolinians in the way that they are, which is over $1 million a year. Really, again, this should be in the legislature.
Americans for Prosperity is a very large organization. They've got state chapters like the one that you're the head of here in North Carolina. Why is this such a big emphasis for AFP, not only across the state, but across the country?
Yeah, I think we saw that. The country has moods, and in the last couple of years, they were in the mood for school choice. They saw this large problem in schools, and we overwhelmingly saw states across the country pass reforms that empowered parents. Now we're seeing that there is this unelected bureaucracy, and this was brought to light through the election last year. President Trump talked about it quite a bit, and it's really kind of come to the forefront. So I think now is the time when people are really talking about how bureaucrats are controlling their lives in ways that they're not elected. So we've seen that. I think other state chapters have seen that. Other organizations have seen that, like the Goldwater Institute. John Locke Foundation is supportive of this. They've been working on this for a long time. Our partner organization, the Libre Initiative, which talks about how this is impacting Hispanics in North Carolina. Everybody's kind of seen this inflection point where the Overton window has moved to where the citizens really want accountability in their governance. So I think that's why we've seen state chapters of AFP pushing this across the country. And that's why we've seen states prioritizing this. And again, this is a bipartisan issue. This is a common sense good governance issue, excuse me.
I want to go back just a couple of years. It was a major decision up in Washington, D.C. The United States Supreme Court ruled on the Chevron Doctrine, which I know is not the exact same situation as the RAINS Act, but that was a major blow to the federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. as it related to agencies and their essential ultimate rulemaking ability that they had, where they could make any rules they wanted and you couldn't sue them for it. They were the truth setters of whatever rule that they set. That faced a major blow in Washington, D.C., had a huge impact. I see kind of some parallels between that and the RAINS Act here in North Carolina.
Yeah, absolutely. The principle is almost exactly the same. Is we want accountability. We don't want people who are sitting in dark, smoke-filled rooms making these decisions that are impacting our pocketbooks, impacting our lives, impacting what jobs we can get, what kind of career paths, what our hobbies are. We want the freedom to do that. And if we don't see that, then we have people we can hold directly accountable, and that's our legislature.
So going through this process here, there's been a bill introduced in both the House and the Senate. Have we heard any comments from Governor Josh Stein, whether he would be in favor or not of this legislation? It would ultimately make it to his desk for a signature or a veto.
That's right.
Any ideas as to what he's thinking on this?
That's right. And not only would this legislation make it to his desk for a signature or veto, but so would all of these new rules after they get passed through the General Assembly. This is actually the first time that the governor would have a seat at the table in the rulemaking process. He is able to see rules that come through, and if he doesn't like them, he can veto them, even if they've been approved by the General Assembly. So it's something that we hope the governor sees as expanding, just expanding it greater to a completely accountable body of elected officials, himself included. While he hasn't said anything on it yet, we're hopeful that he's going to support this and see what kind of common sense good government bill this is.
Tyler, tell us a little bit about Americans for Prosperity in North Carolina, what you guys are doing, some of the other emphases and projects that you're working on.
Yeah, right now. So the RAINS Act is our largest focus. We are knocking doors across the state. We are making phone calls. On Tuesday, we brought activists in. AFP did. The Libre Initiative did, our partner organization. This is our biggest focus of the year, but we're also working on, we want to see Certificate of Need repealed as well. That's continued to be a priority for us. And then just general good governance from the General Assembly, which we've seen for the last 10 years, which has lowered our tax burden and put us in a really strong financial state, a state that when we have disasters come, they're prepared for these disasters. There's money in a rainy day fund that can help alleviate some of the pain. We want North Carolina to continue down the path of strong governance, of financial sanity, which we haven't seen across the country. We've seen states like California, New York, spend themselves into oblivion, tax themselves into oblivion, and there's a reason they're all coming here. So we want North Carolina to continue down the path of good governance, of financial sanity, work towards keeping taxes low. We're working on that every day. But again, our main focus is passing this RAINS Act this year. If you want to learn more, you can go to reininnc.com. Find a whole bunch of information about it, what we're working on, our events, and how you can get involved.
Tell folks where they can follow you on social media and keep up to date with everything going on AFPNC.
Yeah, you can follow AFPNC at AFPNC. And I believe mine is at Tyler J. Voigt on X.
A great update this morning. Tyler Voigt from Americans for Prosperity joins me this morning on the Nick Craig Show. Great information there from Tyler. You can see the website right here. This is a letter that they've got over at AFP, the American for Prosperity website, in talking about the RAINS Act. You can go on there, fill out your information, and encourage legislators in the General Assembly to move forward with the RAINS Act. And really, I hope it came across in the interview, the monumental change that this legislation could have for North Carolina. I mean, we talk about the unelected bureaucracy a lot. We talk about the red tape. We talk about the roadblocks that government puts up at all levels when you're trying to, open a business, start a small business, just live your life. A lot of this is not coming from law. Starting in the North Carolina General Assembly. It is coming from unelected bureaucrats and state agencies. And the RAINS Act would simply state that if you're going to impact people's lives, if you're going to have over $1 million worth of economic impact over a year, 12-month period of time, then that needs to go through a stricter process. The unelected bureaucracy was not put there to generate legislation. That's what our lawmakers in Raleigh were elected to do. We elect them every 2 years in the House and the Senate. We elect a governor every 4 years. Those are the individuals that are responsible with laws, not unelected bureaucrats. This is a major piece of legislation. Appreciate Tyler's time this morning. Appreciate Americans for Prosperity for leading the effort on that. I'll have a show note in the show notes. I'll have all the links that you could possibly need to get more details on that. That'll be available for members over at patreon.com/Nick Craig, where you can support the show and get access to those daily show notes. patreon.com/Nick Craig. Well, we've got some major news that is expected to come out later in the day today. President Donald Trump is expected to sign an executive order today to close the Department of Education, fulfilling a years-long pledge to dismantle the federal agency, according to officials in the White House. Trump is set to host an event later on today at the White House to sign an order directing Education Secretary Linda McMahon to take, quote, all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the Department of Education and return education authority to the states, while continuing to ensure the effective and uninterrupted delivery of services, programs, and benefits on which Americans rely. The USA Today first reported that Trump will sign the order formally closing the department does require an act of Congress, but even without formally shutting it down, the Trump administration could effectively make it nearly impossible for employees to carry out their work as it has been done with the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. President Jimmy Carter established the Department of Education in 1979 after Congress passed the Department of Education Organization Act with bipartisan votes. Linda McMahon recently moved to drastically reduce the size of the department by cutting its workforce in half. She called the job terminations the first step towards shutting down the department. McMahon said last week in an interview with Fox News, quote, "That was the president's mandate. His directive to me clearly is to shut down the Department of Education, which we know we'll have to work with Congress to get accomplished." McMahon similarly vowed at her Senate confirmation hearing to work with Congress to advance Trump's plan to dismantle the department. She telegraphed in an email to employees this month that major changes are coming. She wrote in part in the email, quote, "Our job is to respect the will of the American people and the president that they elected, who has tasked us with accomplishing the elimination of the bureaucratic bloat here at the Department of Education, a momentous final mission quickly and responsibly." The Senate did confirm her in a 51-45 vote. Surprise, surprise, no Democrats voted for her confirmation. So the question that's being asked, I think, is a pretty simple one. Can the Department of Education and all of the things that they fund, all of the things they support, can that information, can those programs, can that be done by the states? And I think the answer is pretty clear. Yes. States already have a major, major hand in education. North Carolina is a great example. It's over half of our state budget every year funds education, whether it's K through 12 education, whether it's the public university system, whether it's the community college system, which is very effective across the state. All of that is done at the state level. It's literally half of our state budget. It's a massive amount of money. And as I understand it, we'll learn more from the president today. We'll likely get some additional comments from the secretary and Linda McMahon as well. The federal government needs to get out of education. Now, they can continue to fund it, and they should continue to fund it. But the Department of Education, similar to proposals that we've heard about FEMA, needs to do nothing more than allocate resources to the state. There is no reason that unelected bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. should be making decisions about how your child is educated. I don't know how I can say it any more succinctly. Tell me how an unelected bureaucrat somewhere within Washington, D.C., inside the Department of Education, knows what's best for your child's education. It just explain to me how that person is the best for your child's education. It doesn't make any sense. There's no justification for there to be so much federal control over education, and there's a crap ton of it. When schools receive money from the federal government, which they almost all do, at least public schools, it comes with red tape and bureaucracy. It comes with, well, then you have to fund these programs at this amount. You have to follow this rule. You have to follow this recommendation. You have to do this. You have to do that. The money comes with so many strings attached that in some cases you've had public schools that have said, to hell with this. Because there's really not that much money that comes from the Department of Education, at least to the local school districts. In the grand scheme of their funding, vast majority is the state and local. The little chunk of that pie that comes from the federal government isn't that much. Now, it's depending on the school district size, it's still millions of dollars a year, sure. But when you're talking about school districts that operate on $100+ million budgets, it's a relatively small chunk. And some school systems have said, no, we're done with this. We're done capitulating to the Department of Education to receive $3.5 million a year. We'll get the money elsewhere. That just shouldn't exist. And same thing at the state level. When the Department of Education gives money to the state to conduct education, it comes with strings and rules attached to it. And there's just no reason for it. We know that education works better when the decisions are made as close to the child as possible. And state government, which are elected by the individuals, right? We elect our General Assembly, as I just mentioned, every 2 years to the House and to the Senate. When those decisions can be made at the state level, and then even more decisions can be made at the local level, from your local school boards, from your county commissioners that fund education throughout the state and all 100 counties, that's a good thing. Right? You want more local control on education. You don't want ambiguous nonsense rules, ambiguous nonsense regulations from the federal government. It's not effective. It does not generate better education for children. Test scores do not rise because the federal government has a larger hand in the cookie jar of education. It just doesn't work like that. I had a graphic a couple of weeks ago. The Department of Education's budget has gone up by like 20% since 2012, over the last 12 to 13 years. Their budget has ballooned by over a quarter. And the result is test scores are lower. Reading, writing, and arithmetic is lower. Individuals' ability to do math is lower. So it's obviously not a money problem, right? The money's there. There's been a continued increase in funding for the Department of Education. And the question is, what is the ROI? What is the return on investment for your taxpayer dollars being sucked out of your paycheck, brought up to Washington, D.C., funneled around in the Department of Education, and then sent back to the local school board, sent back to state government? What is the end result? Not better test scores. The complete opposite, worse test scores. With more and more money, the results aren't getting any better. That's a huge problem. So that is expected to take place up in Washington, D.C. today. I'll have audio and video of that coming up for you tomorrow right here on the Nick Craig Show. A jam-packed edition this morning. Appreciate you being here. Appreciate Tyler Voigt from Americans for Prosperity for providing us some details on the RAINS Act. A busy day across the state and nation today. We'll track all the details, and we'll be back with you tomorrow morning live, 7 a.m., YouTube, Rumble, and X, and 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to The Nick Craig Show. Have a great Thursday. And by the way, go UNCW.